The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. This is our weekly conversation about the Church and the world. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Thank you for joining us on Just Love. And, you know, we are in spring and it's getting near Mother's Day. So Mother's Day is right upon us. And so today we're going to be speaking about one of those issues which is always a little bit sensitive and it's got both its good sides and its bad sides. We're going to speak about foster parenting and foster care, because in the United States these days, there are a lot of children who unfortunately can't be raised in their own homes, you know, hundreds of thousands of them, and they are in foster care. And so we're going to be speaking with Jean Pritchka, who is the founder and the chair of Foster Care Counts. And it's an organization that is dedicated to raising awareness about the needs of foster youth and also providing a little bit of assistance to the foster families and opportunities for people if they want to donate and volunteer efforts on their behalf. And so she's going to be sharing with us some of the work of Foster Care Counts and Foster Mother's Day. And that's kind of an interesting thing for us to be thinking about. So I'm looking forward to speaking with Jean Pritchka in a little bit. Excuse me. And then next, I'm delighted that we're going to be speaking with Harry Conniff Jr., who is a speaker, an actor, songwriter. He's now a television host for the television program Harry, which he hosts daily and it's broadcast in major markets. And so I'm looking forward to speaking with him. Now, I had the privilege of hearing Harry Conniff Jr. a number of years ago when he was one of the people who was the lead in entertainer for the Pope when he came and celebrated Mass at Yankee Stadium. So that was the previous Pope who did that. So I'm delighted that Harry Conniff Jr. has agreed to be with us on our show. So I'm delighted by that. Tom, do we have any news that we want to share with our listeners?
We do, Monsieur. It's been a kind of a busy news week. So we have some news we would like to share. The first is, actually, it was just announced this past week that our president Donald Trump will be visiting Pope Francis at the Vatican on May 24th as part of a foreign trip that he's taking to both Israel and Saudi Arabia. The announcement actually, Monsignor, ended weeks of speculation of whether Trump, who's due to be in Italy on May 26th to 27th for the G7 summit, would request a meeting with the pontiff. It's generally normal that a U.S. president will meet popes, but in early April, it was indicated that President Trump had indicated he wasn't interested. A little bit of background of the trip, a senior administration official had said that the White House arranged Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia and Israel, and then to the Vatican in order to bring together different faith groups and religions to fight religious intolerance. And as you may know, Monsignor, President Trump and Pope Francis have had divergent opinions on a number of issues. Most famously, one of the most tense exchanges was in February 2016, when Trump was campaigning to become the Republican Party's nominee at that time. In advance of Pope Francis's trip to Mexico that month, President Trump on Twitter criticized Pope Francis as a very political person because the pontiff was preparing to celebrate Mass down at the southern side of the U.S.-Mexico border. And then in response, when the Pope was asked about that comment on his press plane home, he said in response that a person who thinks only about building walls, wherever they may be, and not building bridges, is not a Christian. So when asked about the possibility of meeting President Trump this past May on his trip home from Egypt, Pope Francis said he receives every head of state who he has an audience with. And President Trump's going to conclude his first foreign trip as president when he stops at NATO and in Brussels, and May 25th as he takes part in that G7 summit. So we certainly wish the president and the Pope good luck on their first meeting. And
I have a really, really very superficial, very selfish, self-centered comment. I'm delighted. He's not coming to New York. Traffic won't be blocked up, because whenever he comes to New York, he blocks up traffic because he tends to go down the street near where we work. and it's just a mess. So I'm delighted that he's going overseas. Let him deal with traffic in Saudi Arabia. Let him deal with traffic in Italy. And I think that's great. Where else is he going?
He's going to go to Saudi Arabia. He's going to Israel. And then he's going to stop in Brussels.
So he's going to Israel. He's right. going to Israel, Saudi Arabia, and he's going to Italy. Okay. Well, that's good. This is the first trip of President Trump to abroad, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I would say this is his first venture out.
Yeah. Okay. Tom, what other news we got?
Well, actually, in kind of keeping with that, Monsieur, we have some news about religious liberty, if you will. President Trump last week on May 4th signed an executive order titled Promoting Free Speech and Religious Liberty. This order relaxed IRS enforcement of the Johnson Amendment, which bans tax-exempt organizations like churches from political speech and activities, and also gives regulatory relief to companies that object to what was then Obamacare's mandate for contraception coverage in healthcare. It's funny, but by reactions to this order from both the left and the right, it seems that it was much more modest than proponents were hoping for, or as opponents feared. In fact, the ACLU, which had previously indicated it would sue to block the order, reversed course, saying that it would not follow the suit and challenging President Trump's order, because according to the director, Anthony Romero, today's executive order signing was just an elaborate photo op with no discernible policy outcomes. And conversely, the National Review's David French called the executive order worse than useless, and the Heritage Foundation's Ryan T. Anderson called the executive order woefully inadequate. The president of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, Cardinal DiNardo, indicated optimism at the executive order, though, and its impact on the HHS mandate regarding mandatory contraception coverage. But he said the Bishops' Conference was going to review the details of any regulatory proposal. And listeners, if they want to read the executive order, they can go to the White House webpage to the brief room section under presidential actions. It's only 2 pages, Monsignor, so maybe people could take a look at it.
Yeah, Tom, for our listeners, I've read the executive order. I am not an attorney, so I didn't study it. I don't know all of the kind of legal aspects of it, but I've read it. I know enough about the topic to offer the opinion that I tend to agree. It's a very, very kind of limited and a very modest order. It kind of talks about, you know, those two things. It talks about political activity and it talks about the HHS mandate. And, you know, the reality from my point of view, because I think it is a critically important topic, is I guess in all of the conversation, I do think the more we focus on both parts of both clauses of that First Amendment, which basically says that government shall not establish religion and government shall not prohibit the free exercise of religion, I think that provides a pretty good framework for us. Now, I know it's got to be worked out in practice and there are court decisions which have specified what that means, but I think we should kind of stick with that idea that basically, you know, we want to live in a country, and we do live in a country, which believes that religion is so important that it, first of all, gets into the First Amendment of the Constitution. And remember, if for a little bit of history, that it was without those, that Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, it probably wouldn't have gotten passed, because what the founders of this country were really, really, really concerned about is they didn't like big government, and they didn't like government being overly intrusive. And again, a little bit of a history lesson is that they felt that that big government meant that it was the federal government. They kind of liked their own states. They liked Virginia. They liked Massachusetts. They liked Pennsylvania. But they didn't want the big government, which was then not in D.C., but it was in New York. They didn't want big government kind of butting in. So they basically said, we like the Constitution, but let's specify some of the things that are rights that we want to make sure that government doesn't interfere with. And religion, they put at the top of the list. They said, okay, religion's so important. Government, we don't want you preventing people from exercising their religion. And by the way, government, we don't need you to establish religion. Just stay out of it. Let the people worship. Let the people exercise their religion. And I think that's a pretty nice framework for how things are set up. Now, when you apply that in practice, it can mean a variety of different things. And there are a lot of issues which are part of that whole conversation. And so it's good. So now this executive order, in my judgment and in the judgment of a lot of other people, doesn't really do a whole lot to change anything. And but it does do a couple of things, which I think are positive, at least from my point of view. I think it, you know, it does say that there was kind of an overstepping of bounds in some of the way that the healthcare law was written in terms of requiring organizations, religious organizations, to do things which violated their conscience. So I think straightening that out is kind of a positive thing. I'm not a big fan of relaxing the Johnson Amendment, quite frankly, because I think it's a good idea for preachers and religion to not endorse candidates. And, you know, the Johnson Amendment doesn't prevent religious organizations from talking about public policy, talking about what creates a just and a compassionate society. It kind of, though, says, hey, let's not get too political about this. Let's not engage in partisan politics. And even if that amendment is relaxed, I think it's not a bad guide for a lot of religious organizations to talk about policy and not to get overly involved in political campaigns in partisanship. Now, I know there are some religious leaders who kind of think it's okay to get up in the pulpit and to endorse candidates, and I give them their space to hold that opinion. I just don't think it's a place that I want to go. And I have to say, over the years, periodically, when I thought there was some pretty clear choices between candidates who are running for office, I still think, even in those cases, for the most part, it's a good idea for a religious organization, and particularly that preachers and pulpits shouldn't pick on particular candidates for their support. So anyway, that's just my take on the religious freedom executive order. I think we still have our Constitution, we still have our Bill of Rights, and I think that has served us well, but we got to play with it. We have to make sure that it is respected. So let's take a break. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. When we come back, we're going to be speaking about Foster Mother's Day, and we're going to be speaking about foster care, which happens when sometimes parents and moms in particular can't take care of their kids. Kids wind up being in foster care. So as we kind of get ready to celebrate Mother's Day, we're going to focus on a particular aspect of Mother's Day. So join us when we come back in just a few minutes. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love, the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Thank you for being with us today. And we're getting ready to celebrate Mother's Day. And for that reason, I'm delighted that we have as our guest now Jean Prichter, who is the founder and chair of Foster Care Counts, an organization that tries to provide support for foster parents and foster children. So I'm delighted that she is with us. And Jean Prichter, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great. So tell our listeners a little bit, first of all, what is Foster Care Counts? I think people generally know what foster care is, but tell us about Foster Care Counts. Tell us about that organization that you founded.
Okay. Well, we created Foster Care Counts to raise awareness of the issue of foster care and raise money to help support the great organizations out in the country that serve foster youth. We have found that there's so many ways that people can get involved, the community in general, and by becoming more aware of and supporting organizations, we can direct individuals who want to help and get involved at any level to the organizations that exist that are waiting for volunteers and support.
And how do you do that? I mean, what type of help, what type of support do you provide?
Well, what we do is we encourage people, we go out into the community and we talk about foster care and really what it is and what it means. And we encourage people, particularly, we like to start out small. We encourage people to think about donating gently used clothes and household items to foster care agencies and foster families who need them because they're working on raising a lot of kids. And in particular, right now, we're working on an initiative to support foster youth who are in college and trying to graduate from college. And really, we spend a lot of time with agencies and organizations to find out what the particular needs, the greatest needs of foster youth are that can be supported by community members, and then get that information out to the community, to people who express interest in being involved.
So maybe for our listeners who might not be quite so familiar, could you kind of share with our listeners about a little bit what foster care is and how, a child or youth might wind up with a foster parent? Give our listeners a little bit of sense about that across the United States.
Right, because the truth is, when I first found out about it, I knew what the word foster care was, but I also had really very little sense of what that meant. And I find that many people that I speak to about the subject, same thing. They if you say, what is foster care, they'll say, yes, I know what it is, and one has an idea. But generally, what happens is when a parent or parents are struggling for so many different reasons with their own lives, their family lives, their work lives, it will come to the attention of somebody in that child's life through various ways that there may be problems at home. A lot of times it comes from school. And so usually somebody who notices or has an idea that the family may be struggling at home may call social services, the local social services organization, who then sends out a social worker who literally goes to the family's home and will spend some time talking with the family to understand what's going on in the family and how, if, when, and where public support services can be made available to help support the family when they're undergoing times of trouble. In some cases, the kinds of support that families need during this time require that the kids are temporarily not living with the family while government services work to secure the family and help to bring resources that can support their growth and strength to the point where they can reunite their families. So the children are placed in a foster family situation, which means temporarily their care is under the aegis of a foster family and also of the government social services, who are all working to ensure that the child continues as well as possible their normal life, their schooling, certainly their nutrition and health, and they maintain regular contact with the biological family if and when possible, so that during the rehabilitation process of the family, the children are a part of this. And all the parties involved in social services system and the foster care system work together to really try to keep this time when the child's away from home as smooth as possible.
Jeannie Prichter, who is the founder and the chair of Foster Care Counts, which is an organization that tries to provide support to those who are they tries to raise awareness about the foster care and support to children and the families who are involved with foster care. Jeannie, that was a very, very, I think, good description. I think it provide our listeners with a kind of a very full picture of that. And unfortunately, what you described is such at times a very heart-wrenching and difficult situation, because it's just very, very sad that that a child might be in a family in which there is neglect and abuse, and therefore, for the protection of that child, the state needs to intervene and say, listen, for the safety of the child, this child just can't stay there any longer and has to be placed in a foster care home. And so it is a very, very sad thing. And as you talked about, the goal is to make sure that child is as safe as they can be and taken away from their own biological families for as brief a period of time. And if they can't go back to their own family, then they kind of look to make sure they're adopted so that they can be in another permanent situation. So it is, thank you for describing that to our listeners. What I would like you to kind of speak a little bit more about, because you talked about some of the older kids who either may still be in foster care, or maybe they're no longer in foster care, who are in college or a little bit further. So talk a little bit about what Foster Care Counts is doing with that part of the foster care care youth.
Well, what we're actually working on, our ultimate goal is to be able to, and many people are working on this, and we think it really will be the most effective solution if we can, once this gets underway, is to be able to provide mentors. In our specific case, we're looking to provide e-mentors who would communicate with young adults via technology, Skype, text, phone, and mentor them through their transitional journey to adulthood, if you will, whether it be going to college and trying to graduate from college, or looking for a job in a career post high school, or graduating high school and getting a job, to really be able to provide either an academic mentor or a job mentor, and help, provide some of the guidance and support that parents would typically offer to their children as they transition to adulthood, be able to provide that for these young people as they transition, and to be a beacon of experience and knowledge, and a place where young people can turn as they have questions and concerns and confusion during the transition time, which is always hard. So mentoring, coaching is really what we're looking to do. And we're developing quite a structured program so that somebody who will be coaching or mentoring a young person really has a lot of information at their hands about how they can help, where they can help, where they shouldn't help, and how and where to refer young people to other resources when the mentor when it's something the mentor can't help with.
Now, Gina, you're talking about those children who are no longer in part of the foster care program, the foster care system?
It goes two ways. So in many states, in approximately 25 states, young people can stay in foster care up to 21 years of age, as long as they're either in school or employed. Generally, by that time, they choose not to live in a foster family, although they do stay in care. And at that point, especially when they're not with a foster family, the opportunity to provide an e-mentor or e-coach to help support the social worker and the government support system that they will still retain will be very, very useful. And yes, in particular, after they turn 21 years old or in states where they emancipate from foster care at 18, they have no further public support whatsoever. And at that time, it becomes excruciatingly critical to step in and provide some alternatives.
And how many young people are you hoping to be able to provide mentors to, let's say, in the upcoming year or so?
In the upcoming year, we'll pilot a small program just to make sure that the methods that we are planning on using are robust and rigorous. We want to work with a small number of young people while we work out any kinks in the model that we will be implementing.
And that makes a lot of sense. So how many?
Probably, I would say not more than 100 young people, because we also want to be able to really get that critical group a lot of input from them as to what they need. And these are young adults now with lots of experience, and we're hoping that they'll really be able to provide a tremendous amount of insight into what will help young people transition the best.
Well, I mean, I think the experience that a lot of people have found out, the two essentials that kids who are making that transition need, they need a job and they need a house. They need someplace to live, and they need someplace where they can earn some money. And I think the part that you're talking about is also the other thing that I think is critically important, why I think that this mentor program is so positive, because the kids need some support. They need some kind of connection or relationship, and this could be the one that could be critically important to helping them to kind of move forward in their lives.
That's what we're hoping.
Yeah. Yeah. It's and are you focusing in one particular geographic area, or are you kind of spread out?
I'm in Los Angeles. Los Angeles has the undistinct honor of having the highest number of foster youth per capita of any city in the country.
Huh. Why do you think? I'm intrigued. Why is that?
That's a really good question. And actually, I'm probably pretty sure there's some significant theories and some data to support theories, but one of the reasons is it's one of the largest cities. And so just with respect to population, it would make sense.
Well, no, but you said it was per capita.
Well, that is true.
Yeah. So, you know, the intriguing, I'm interested, because does Los Angeles or California have a significant preventive service program?
Well, yeah, it does. It really does. But whether California does a better or worse job than any other city in the country of taking care of its young people and its foster youth, I'm not sure.
Right.
Why do you think California?
Well, I don't know enough about the system, but I know what has happened in a number of other parts of the country is that many parts of the country have reduced the number of kids into foster care because they've placed a lot more emphasis as you described so well when we began our conversation, that, you know, there's a report of something not going well in a family, that that the jurisdiction says, hey, let's not try to take the kid out there, but let's see if we can't provide some supports to that family so that the family can stay intact and the child can stay intact. If you don't do that, you're going to wind up with a greater number of kids in foster care. If you put your emphasis on prevention, you can reduce the number. So it may well be that that maybe Los Angeles, you know, doesn't put as much emphasis on prevention. But I don't know. I don't know the reason.
That's so interesting that you mentioned that, because we just participated in a very large nationwide study to study the whole system, and one of the major conclusions that we reached was the importance of dividing funding between supporting foster care and in prevention. And so I think everyone is on that page.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you brought it up. That's right in the forefront of all policy in terms of how we use spending and the people who are thinking about it. That is what everyone's thinking at the moment.
Well, and again, I know the New York system far better than any place else in the country, but I can just tell you the numbers in New York. The numbers in New York were that in the 90s or so, there were close to, not exactly, but close to 50,000 kids in foster care on any given night. Today, there are about 10,000. So that number has dramatically decreased for a variety of reasons. At the other hand, the number of kids who are now receiving preventive services has increased tremendously. Not to the same extent, but it's increased. So that's a real interesting, that I think you're right. That is the way that people are trying to move. So listen.
That's sort of our next step.
Yeah. So Jeannie Prichter, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us, and the best of luck. And I hope maybe sometime I can talk to you again to see how that e-mentoring program is going, because I think that's a really critical part of that transitioning of young people to kind of living more independently.
That sounds great.
Good. Jeannie Prichter, who is the founder and chair of Foster Care Counts, thanks for being with us on Just Love. We're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we're going to be speaking with Harry Conniff Jr. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just, and it will be more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a moment or two on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Well, we're getting close to Mother's Day, and we just had a conversation about foster mothers and foster parents. And when we think about Mother's Day, we think about family. And I'm delighted that our guest is Harry Conniff Jr., and I'm delighted that he's with us as we're kind of getting close to our Mother's Day show. Harry Conniff Jr., thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Hey, I just got to tell you, you don't know me from anybody, but I saw you when you were entertaining before, I think, Pope Benedict did Mass at Yankee Stadium.
So yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that was a great performance. I was standing there, and it was really great. So thanks for doing that.
Oh, listen, it was a great honor. You know, when a call like that comes in, I jump at that. I mean, that's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime thing. And if you can believe it, it was a twice-in-a-lifetime thing, because when Pope Francis came to New York, I was lucky enough to be asked to sing at the Papal Mass for him, too. So that was really thrilling, and I was quite honored.
Well, they never asked me to sing at anything, because if I did, I'd clear the house. So that's great. So hey, now, you're from New Orleans, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
Well, I got a great, strong, positive feeling in my heart for New Orleans, because one of your confreres is so involved with us in Catholic Charities up here, Rusty Staub.
Oh, sure.
Rusty is so generous with supporting our food pantries and our emergency food program. So I just have a really, really positive feeling in my heart for New Orleans. So thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Thank you.
So we're getting near Mother's Day. So tell us a little bit about your own family and how kind of your family has influenced kind of who you are today.
Well, I met my wife 27 years ago. Her name is Jill. And we married 23 years ago, and we were fortunate enough to have three daughters, Georgia, who is 21, Kate, who is 19, and Charlotte is 14. And, you know, I like to tell people I married up, because Jill is very bright and very strong in her convictions and a great inspiration to me. And I think we make a great team, and we share values concerning how we parent our kids. And now I have these three young women in my life that I've grown to respect and depend on because of their unique perspectives on things, and it's just been a great blessing to me.
Well, you know, Harry, I have to do this or I can't go back to work today, that you told me that you're married. Somebody on my staff is getting married in a short period of time. But when I told her that I was going to come here today and was interviewing you, she said, "You have to tell Harry Conniff that I love him. I'm in love with him." So I had to tell you that for Luce's sake, even though she's getting married in a few weeks, she still is in love with you, and you can be in love with your wife.
That's really nice. Love is a great thing. As long as we understand what kind of love it is, I think you can work out. You know.
Yes, we can do that. So so let's move a little bit forward. So you talked about your wife and how you married up. How'd you get involved in kind of the entertainment business and music and stuff like that?
Well, I was really lucky because I was born in New Orleans, which most people know is a city that is filled with music and entertainment. But more importantly, I had two parents who were not only dedicated to my and my sister's well-being and education, but they made it very easy for us to get access to a lot of this music. For example, I would go down to the French Quarter with my mom and dad and my sister from the time I was a kid, and we would go to these jazz clubs at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And there were all kinds of people walking around the French Quarter, not just a lot of people who don't know the French Quarter might think of Bourbon Street as, you know, all adults and risque at times, and it is at times, but if you go down there on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday afternoon, their families walking around. They have doors to these beautiful clubs with jazz music playing. And I used to go and listen, and would frequently sit in with these musicians, and I'm not sure what compelled me to want to play and sing and entertain. I'm sure it's a combination of the personalities of my parents, but I did want to do that, whereas some kids might want to, you know, go play football or, you know, be on the track team. I was obsessed with playing music, and when you take my parents' you know, interest in that and the access to this incredible music, it was sort of a perfect storm for me to grow and learn. It was an incredible situation.
Now, did your parents make you or encourage you, or did you have like music lessons when you were growing up?
Yeah, I started taking music lessons when I was probably 6 years old, 7 years old, taking piano lessons. And by the time I was, I don't know, 9 or 10, I was playing with the symphony down there, playing one of Beethoven's piano concertos.
Harry, that's where I went wrong, because when I was 7 or 8, my mom said, you know, you should take some piano lessons. I said, yeah, but it's the same time as bowling, and I want to go bowling.
Well, listen, I tell you, I wouldn't mind if my bowling game were a little bit better. There are times when I wish I could bowl, and I would have skipped piano if I didn't embarrass myself at the bowling alley. But it was, you know, I loved it. I had amazing access and opportunity, so I was really lucky.
Oh, that's great. And but the other thing which I think is a little interesting about your growing up and stuff, your dad was Catholic, but your mom was not Catholic, right? She was Jewish?
Right. So she was born in New York City to a Jewish family, and my father was born in Mobile, Alabama as a Catholic. And they met, long story short, in North Africa back in the 50s, got married, and moved to New Orleans, where my dad was living since he was a little kid. And by the time I came along, my mom was kind of, I would say she was non-denominational, although she was very well-versed not only in the faith that she was brought up in, but in the Christian faith, too. She was probably more familiar with the Bible than some of the Christians that I know. And my dad is 91. My mother died when I was 13. My father, who's 91 now, is still a devout Catholic. So it was an interesting way to be brought up, because I wasn't baptized as a baby. My mother wanted me and my sister to decide for ourselves what religion we wanted to be. And my father would have preferred us being baptized in the Catholic Church. But ultimately, we decided that we wanted to be Catholic. I think my sister was around 17. I was around 14 when I decided.
Now, was that after your mom had passed away?
Yes. I had been somewhere around that time. I was going to catechism and studying. I went to a Jesuit high school. Actually, now that I think about it, I think it was somewhere in my freshman year, so that must have been right after my mother died, that I started to become more interested in the church and, you know, did all of my lessons to become a Catholic and got baptized and confirmed when I was 14.
So I assume that your own children are Catholic, are they?
Yeah, all my daughters are Catholic. And in terms of their thoughts and beliefs, they're very smart, and they have a lot of questions, which I think is a good thing. And I would never speak on their behalf in terms of what they think about religion or Christianity, but I know that they're very bright, and they are all Catholic. So, but they're, you know, going through a time just like I did, and continue to do sometimes when you have questions about things and you try to find the answers. And I think that it's all very healthy.
Well, were they baptized as children, though?
Yes, they were all baptized as babies.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think sometimes, you know, I think those of us who practice our faith, and sometimes people get the impression that, well, if you're practicing your faith, you don't have any doubts, or you got it all figured out. And that's not the case at all. There's got to be, you know, a healthy amount of seeking to deepen a relationship. But sometimes when you seek to deepen a relationship with God, some things pop out of the woods and you say, gee, where'd that come from? Gee, I don't like that part, or stuff like that. And, you know, my favorite story, among my favorite stories is, you know, the story when those, when the disciples went to, now there are various stories, but when they went to the tomb on Easter Sunday morning and they didn't find Jesus there, you know, some of the commentators in the scriptures say, you know, they didn't really have it all figured out. They didn't know what it all meant. And so I think that's a little bit of a guide for all of us. We're on our journey. We try to figure it out. We try to be faithful. But, you know, we don't have it all figured out. God's greater than us, and we still got a lot more to know about God.
I agree. And I think sometimes I look at my position in my life and the platforms from which I'm able to do what I love. And right now particularly is a very highly visible platform, one of national television syndication. And sometimes I wonder, you know, although I don't like to preach on my show, or I have no aversion to talking about my faith, or if anybody else wants to talk about their faith, I welcome that actually. But it's not a show where I shove my values down anybody else's throat. But I try to lead by example as best as I can. And sometimes I think, well, why me? Like, you know, wouldn't they have, you know, found someone who is much closer to being a perfect Christian than I am? Or wouldn't that have been the fate of somebody who's a better Christian than I am? And then I think this is a kind of a back door kitchen table conversation. This isn't me coming through the front door with trumpets and saying, listen to me, this is what I believe. I'm the best example of a Catholic you'll find. This is a guy who is trying to understand things, trying to understand imperfection, and trying to be a better person. And what I've learned throughout my life is that most of us are like that. Even people, you know, who I know who make the priesthood their vocation, or people who dedicate their lives to theology or religion, they like you say, they question things too. And people ask me if I'm a practicing Catholic, and I always tell them I am, and I'm going to keep practicing until I get it right.
Right.
And it's an incredible path. I mean, it's something that I take pride in, and I'm in no rush to you know, try to be better at being, you know, a father and being a husband. I want to take my time to do those things as best as I can.
So tell me a little bit about your show, about Harry. I mean, I know you said you don't preach on it, but obviously you have a show. It's your personality that comes out. Tell me a little bit about the show. Do you enjoy doing it?
I love it. It's an incredible, incredible opportunity for me, because all of the things that I love to do are under one roof. I get to have my band there. We play live music every day. That's the only place you're going to see that on daytime TV. I love to have incredible people. We have a segment called Leading Ladies, where it was very important to me when we started, and this was my idea because this is how much I believed in it, to celebrate women.
I hope you had as your first guest your wife.
She's been on numerous
times.
Okay,
good.
I think people would get tired of that every show, but I would have her on every show if I could. But there are some amazing, I've been surrounded by amazing women my whole life, and we do our best to try to feature as many of these incredible women as we can. So there's aspirational stories, inspirational stories, and it's an incredible way for me to do all of the things that I love and the things that I believe by example. You know, not to disparage anybody else who has television shows out there, but I want people to know that they have a choice with the Harry Show, that they can turn it on and not have to worry about hitting the mute button if their kids or their parents are in the room. Or I want to do a show that's positive, that's not political, There are plenty of other shows that do lots of other things really, really well. But what I like to try to do well is entertain in a clean, fun, smart way with amazing guests and amazing music. And to be able to do that five times a week is really an incredible honor.
You've been doing it now for a couple of years?
We just wrapped our first year. Ah. Well, we didn't really wrap. It's still on TV every day. But we're going to be going into our second year, so we're very fortunate.
Isn't that the real test, whether they invite you back for a second year?
It is, especially in syndicated television. In other words, people listening to your station now may be watching it on Fox. They may be watching it on NBC, because in every city it's on in a different channel in a different time. That's called syndicated TV, as opposed to network TV, which means it's only on Fox or only on NBC. Ah. So people have to check their local listings to see not only the channel but the station. And to be asked to come back is a really big deal, and we take it seriously, and we want to be even better in year two. And we had a blast in year one.
Where do you tape?
We tape in New York City on 57th Street.
Yay! Oh, that's great. You tape to before a live audience?
We tape before a live audience, and they can go to my website or harrytv.com, and they can see when they can get tickets to the show, and it's really a blast. I mean, I wish we could play it with no commercials, do the show with no commercials, because we have so much fun in the commercial breaks and and playing music, and people are dancing, and it's a really good time.
So, but you can't say when it's on, because it's on at different times in different markets, right?
Exactly. So people, if they want to see it, they have to check their local listings. And to be honest, that's the toughest part about being on a national television show is getting the word out and telling people, hey, we're on TV every day, but I want people to know that they have a choice. They're not going to turn on the TV and see anything that's inappropriate or bad taste.
Hey, listen, you have been so generous with your time today, and thank you so much, Harry Conniff Jr., and thank you for doing the television show, because I think, I don't want to get political about this, but I'm just going to say it. I am so upset by kind of the way that our politics is going, and not the policies. I mean, some of those bother me a whole lot, but the lack of civility, and we kind of seem to be the only way we can get attention is by insulting somebody, and whoever insults somebody or who's ever most extreme gets the most attention. And so that you're doing a show which kind of is civil, it's funny, it's humorous, it's entertaining, but it appeals to, what is the best about our humanity. I just want to thank you for lending your energy to doing that.
Listen, it's a pleasure. And people come up to me. One woman, she came up to me, her husband, they were in their early 30s, and the guy was a serviceman. He had served in Afghanistan. He was in Army intelligence. And his wife came up to me. They have four children. And she said, you're doing a really good show, and you're getting away with it. And I thought that was so funny. Like, we've come to a place where you have to sneak goodness in.
Right.
And not that it's tame or not edgy, because anything you talk about, has the potential to be, edgy sometimes.
Right.
But we, like you say, we don't cut anybody down. We just sing and dance and have fun.
Oh, that's great. Well, and actually, you're on 57th Street. My office is on 55th Street. I'm gonna come over sometime
and come see us.
I would love to.
Bring your dancing shoes, just don't sing.
Oh, I promise. Okay. Harry Conniff Jr., thank you so much for being with us on Just Love.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great. I'm delighted. I'm so delighted that he's doing a show that is really geared to the best of what's in us, but yet entertaining us in a variety of ways. And I think that's good. So, listen, let me say a happy, happy Mother's Day to all of our listeners out there, and that we have, that people have, and then we talked about foster care. And so, some people this Mother's Day won't have a very happy happy Mother's Day, because, you know, there are women who are unable to have kids, and that can be a very trying, it can be a very troubling situation. So to them also, we want to wish our prayers, our blessings to them. And, you know, sometimes moms are struggling, and sometimes moms don't, and that's why we have, unfortunately, you know, hundreds of thousands of kids in our foster care system throughout the United States. And so let's say a prayer for those moms who are struggling and who maybe sometimes don't fulfill their responsibilities to be the good mothers that they should. And let's kind of pray for God's grace, that God's grace be with them and that they are able to kind of be better moms. And but, you know, the other thing I also think we really need to do is we really need to say thanks to the moms who are doing such great job with their kids, because, you know, sometimes people kind of say, oh, well, you know, she has it so easy. She really, look at how well her life. But, you know, I don't know that there's anybody who doesn't provide, who isn't doing a good job as a mom, who isn't sacrificing, who isn't struggling. And I think part of it is they make it look easy. And that's a great grace and a great gift to all of us. Thanks for being with us on the Catholic Channel this week. Just love. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself. Our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.